From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, actress and writer Carrie Fisher. In her best-selling novel, she turns the worst experiences of her life into fodder for comedy. Postcards from the Edge was about an actress's problems with addiction and rehab. In Fisher's new sequel, The Best Awful, the actress's husband leaves her for a man, and then she's diagnosed with bipolar disorder. Also, Egyptian human rights activist and publisher Hisham Kasem tells us how he manages to keep publishing his independent English-language weekly news magazine, Cairo Times, despite being banned from publishing in Egypt. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. The news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Massachusetts' highest court has ruled that civil unions are not an acceptable substitute for same-sex marriages. Fred Tice reports from member station WBUR in Boston.
The Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court ruled last November that the state could not bar same-sex couples from getting married, but it also gave the legislature 6 months to take appropriate action. And that last part of the decision created some confusion as to just what that appropriate action might be. The state Senate asked the court if civil unions would be an acceptable substitute for same-sex marriages. Wednesday, the court replied no. The court said because the proposed civil union law forbids same-sex couples from getting married, it still relegates them to second-class status. Opponents of gay marriage have offered an amendment to the state constitution that would define marriage as the union of a man and a woman. For NPR News, I'm Fred Tice in Boston.
In a change of policy, President Bush said today that he now supports giving more time to the commission investigating the September 11th terrorist attacks. White House spokesman Scott McClellan urged Congress to extend the deadline for the commission's report.
We urge Congress to act quickly to extend the timetable for an additional 60 days for the commission to complete its work. I would continue to reiterate that if the commission has information that can help prevent another catastrophic terrorist attack on American soil, we need to have that information as soon as possible.
The commission was supposed to finish its work on May 27th, but commission members have asked Congress to extend the deadline by 2 months. The president initially opposed that request, saying the commission should finish its report as quickly as possible. North Carolina Senator John Edwards continued to campaign in the South following last night's primary victory in South Carolina. Edwards visited supporters in Memphis, Tennessee this morning. Jeff Bossert reports from member station WKNO.
Edwards says the proper candidate for the White House shouldn't be based on experience in Washington, but have the qualities of leadership and to be willing to stand up for what you believe in. Reflecting on his life growing up in the South, he believes he has a personal responsibility not to follow but lead when it comes to race.
I have heard some of the pundits and some of the politicians debating where in America and in front of what audiences we should talk about these issues of race and equality and civil rights. Well, I've come from Iowa to New Hampshire to South Carolina, now to Memphis. I'll tell you where we should talk about it, everywhere.
Edwards says his victory in South Carolina will have a huge impact on his campaign fundraising, and predicts what he calls a strong horse race with frontrunner John Kerry the rest of the way. For NPR News, I'm Jeff Bossert in Memphis.
In stocks, the Dow lost 34 points today to close at 10,470. The Nasdaq was down 52 to 2014. This is NPR News. The number of minorities receiving kidney transplants has risen following some changes in the way of deciding who's eligible for the operation. That's according to a study in the New England Journal of Medicine. NPR's Joseph Shapiro reports.
Last spring, a change was made to the national system of matching kidneys. The point was to make more organs available to minorities. About one-third of Americans on the waiting list for kidney transplants are Black. One reason is that first choice went to patients who were perfect matches of six genetic markers. Matching all six increased one's chances of tolerating a transplanted kidney, but African Americans are more genetically diverse, and that made them less likely to match all six markers. The change last year dropped one of those six markers, and now the new study shows kidney transplants to minorities did rise by 7%. Researchers project the change will increase the number of failed kidney transplants, but only by 2%. Joseph Shapiro, NPR News, Washington.
The union representing Southern California supermarket workers is calling for binding arbitration to end a strike and lockouts by three supermarket chains. The United Food and Commercial Workers Union said it was prepared to accept binding arbitration and end its strike if the supermarkets will end their lockouts, fire replacement workers, and call all striking and locked-out employees back to work immediately. So far, the supermarkets have refused that offer. The union has been involved in a four-month-old dispute over health care with Kroger Company, Albertsons, and Safeway. It represents some 70,000 workers in Southern California. In stocks today, the S&P 500 lost 9 points to close at 1,126. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
The NPR Shop features The Geographic Century, a CD from NPR's radio expeditions on great moments of exploration in the 20th century, at npr.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. How funny does this sound? An actress feels lost after her husband leaves her for a man. Her extreme mood swings become so extreme, she ends up in a mental hospital and is diagnosed with bipolar disorder. Well, it isn't necessarily the plot that makes Carrie Fisher's new novel, The Best Awful, funny. It's her observations. This plot is based on her own life. The main character, Suzanne Vail, was also at the center of Fisher's best-selling novel, Postcards from the Edge. Meryl Streep played her in the movie adaptation. Like the character Suzanne Vail, Carrie Fisher is the daughter of celebrity parents. Her mother, Debbie Reynolds, and her father, Eddie Fisher, divorced when Carrie was young. Carrie Fisher's first brush with being a celebrity in her own right was when she played Princess Leia in Star Wars. Here's a short reading from the beginning of her novel, The Best Awful. The first chapter is called The Man Who Got the Man That Got Away.
Suzanne Vail had a problem, and it was the one she least liked thinking about. She'd had a child with someone who forgot to tell her he was gay. He forgot to tell her, and she forgot to notice. He might have forgotten to mention it because he hoped she would save him, making him into a normal family man with a wife and a child and a job running a studio. And hadn't she wanted to be saved from certain things also? From life alone, from being childless, from a life that might have looked a little sad from the outside? So merging their secret hopes for rescue, they'd had a baby with their unwritten pact of androgyny, an androgyny that informed the life they lived out loud. Suzanne had never seen herself as what she called a squeezy, tilty girl. She was a breadwinner with a very yang personality, a person who wore a lot of severely tailored little black suits. And Leland Franklin would never be called up for the Butch Patrol. Not that he was effeminate in any way. Far from it. Suzanne's pregnancy had betrayed their pact, however, transforming her into a girl, a vulnerable woman even, leaving Leland to be what he couldn't, a straight and certain man, certain of his sexuality anyway. Looking back, perhaps Suzanne should have guessed, based on his affection for Biedermeier furniture or even his fastidiousness with his grooming, she should have known when, toward the end, he'd begun rigorously attending a gym, perfecting a body she knew wasn't being perfected for her. Their alliance had broken under the strain of their attempt at normalcy gone wrong. When their daughter Honey was 3, Leland had left her for a man, though initially this was not what he'd said. He'd said he was leaving because Suzanne was crazy, kept him up all night, refused to take her bipolar medication, and she would talk all the time. Maybe she'd talked him out of staying with her, won the argument for why to leave her without meaning to.
That's Carrie Fisher reading from the opening of her new novel, The Best Awful. Carrie Fisher, welcome back to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
How much of this novel is based on your life?
Oh, a hell of a lot of it.
Right. Well, the father of your child left the marriage because he was gay. Was that a shock for you?
Oh, my God, yes. It's not, I've split up for all the usual reasons, and you can see those coming, the buffalo hooves on that one. You can sort of feel those coming from, you know, the distance in that prairie, but you can't sense the gay thing coming as easily. It comes from a different sort of, it doesn't come out of the blue. It comes out of a color you don't know.
When it happened, did it make you want to, like, replay the whole marriage and look for clues that you might not have noticed and rethink everything that happened?
Well, you always want to do that, but what you do more in this thing than you do in any other situation is you blame yourself. How dumb you were! So that, you know, you just, that's the thing that you do. It doesn't even matter what you replay. How could you not have known? So no matter what you're going to end up looking at, you're humiliated, and you just imagine that everyone's looking at you like, how dumb could she be? I mean, all of us, you know, could be cheated on with women and stuff like that, but it takes a special kind of idiot. That's what I thought anyway.
But I could easily imagine it feeling the other way around, that, you know, you didn't realize he was gay. He didn't realize he was gay, or at least he wasn't ready to act on it yet. And it's not like he was leaving you for another woman. It's not like another woman was
outdoing you. He was rejecting the whole sex.
Well, he was just, he had changed, either in his orientation or on his ability to act on that orientation. So in a way, it's less personal. He's not rejecting you for another woman. It's just that you know, women aren't it anymore for him.
Well, or I think they never really had been, but it doesn't matter. You're just squashed. Mm-hmm, you know, there's no way you can philosophically take up some sort of flag and wave it to yourself and look in the mirror and say, okay, you know, I'm okay about this now. It takes a really long time, and I think I would have been better off with it had I not had a child. So that's why it took me a long time to write about it. It just wasn't funny to me. I think I would have been able to make it funny to me faster.
Can you talk about what that process is like of taking something that is like the really
awful,
most horrible thing that can happen to you, and then, you know, over time you turn it into a comic novel?
Look how long it took me.
How long?
Well, I was taking two really bad situations, and, you know, tragedy plus comedy, plus time is comedy. It took a lot of time to make a mental hospital and being left by a man for a man to be a joke. But they happened sort of a close, you know, on each other's heels, so it took me a while to make them funny. But I got there, and I knew it when I started being, you know, you get called, when I had my drug problem, and then after that I was the person who was called when other people had their drug problems. So now I get called when women get left by a man for a man, and I get called when people are bipolar. And I get extra ones, too, just, you know, thrown in. But I know what to say now. I can make it a little easier. It's a drag being a pioneer on the, I say that I turn men gay. I say that it's my superpower. And, that was one of the things that I, when it was all very upset, and everything was upsetting in the beginning, and it was one of the first things that we were sort of arguing and everything was upsetting and crazy. And my ex sort of said, you know, maybe it was my fault because I sort of took codeine again and it was my fault that he was gay. And I said, oh, yeah, well, I didn't read that, you know, warning on the bottle. I thought it said, you know, heavy machinery, not homosexuality. I could have been, you know, riding those tractors all along.
Wait a minute. No, I thought that line is in the book. I thought
yes,
that was very
is.
Funny. You actually said that in real life?
You see? That's why I say if my life wasn't funny, it would just be true, and that's just would be unacceptable. So, yes, that's true.
That's good to be able to quip like that in real life. Some people who do it can only do it on the page.
But, I mean, my life is sort of, not even sort of. My life is insane. It used to be sort of insane. Now I've actually been committed to an asylum. I don't think they call them asylums anymore. They've taken all the romance out of them.
Carrie Fisher is my guest, and her new novel is called The Best Awful. Now, you know, your character in the novel has two big problems. One is that her husband's left her for another man, and two is that she's becoming more extreme in her mood swings and is finally diagnosed as bipolar, manic depressive. And this has happened to you as well. Now, your character in the novel, when she's going through a manic period, will not only, like, just talk, she doesn't want to sleep. At 3 a.m, while the rest of her family is trying to sleep, she can be hammering away, trying to lift the, trying to redo the tiling on the patio at 3 a.m.
Mm-hmm.
But she likes these manic phases, but then when she gets depressed, life becomes quite unbearable. What do you find so appealing about the manic part of manic depression?
Well, but what every manic does, I mean, it's liquid confidence. You feel everything that you do feels charmed and feels sort of like the best idea you've ever had in your life, and like you can do it better than anybody else and should do it and have been chosen to do it by some god or other, and should stay up all night doing it and should get everyone in the world up to do it with you. It's an extraordinary feeling, and it's unlike any drug, and I've taken all of those. And there is no drug that you can say, oh, it's just like, I mean, it's this amazing feeling of just being the chosen one. And it eventually goes terribly awry. But, you know, just imagine feeling just like nobody could resist you, just like you could do anything that you want to do. Any talent, any thing that you pursue, you could get done.
And then when the mania gives way to depression, do you get depressed about the same things you'd previously been manic about?
Well, I used to say that the facts about my life stay the same. Just the fiction I make up about them differs. So, I mean, everything, it just, the light goes out of it. So it would be what Winston Churchill called the black dog then. You would just bleed the light out of the world. And it's weather. So on one day you have just this incredibly great weather and nothing you touch could go wrong. And then the next day it's horrible. It's horrible. And you know something, just pure evil is coming to get you, and you don't know from what source, but you're doomed. And you're powerless to keep that doom away from you.
Were you good at working during the manic periods, working on writing?
Of course. And there's a certain point when, of course not, because you can't sit still. But for a long period, if it goes for a long period, yes, absolutely. And then it just gets to a point where you cannot sit still and you're off to India.
How did you figure out that you were bipolar, that you had bipolar disorder?
Uh-huh. Somebody had to tell me, and I had to be told by a lot of different people over the years. I was told when I was 24, which I thought was very annoying. And they told me at 24, and I was still taking drugs, and you really, when someone's drug addicted or alcoholic and you're still taking a lot of substances or drinking a lot, that looks like manic depression. You can't really accurately diagnose someone, I think. Or I've been told that. So, but when I got sober for the first time when I was 28, I was told again, quite emphatically, and I believed it. Or I said I would, you know, try it their way. And so I took lithium for a year, but I said I would take it, reserving the right to go off it if I didn't like it. So at the first opportunity, I went off lithium.
What didn't you like about it?
It put too much air in my world.
What does that mean?
And I just, I used to think I wanted to feel like others seemed, but I didn't have as much fun, and there were less surprises. So I was in Australia, and I went off the lithium, and I wanted to go to China because it was near. I ended up getting in a lot of trouble.
My guest is Carrie Fisher. Her new novel, The Best Awful, is a sequel to her bestseller, Postcards from the Edge. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. We'll be right back. My guest is actress and writer Carrie Fisher. Her new novel is called The Best Awful. It's about an actress whose husband leaves her for a man, and then her extreme mood swings are diagnosed as bipolar disorder. You know, in an earlier part of your life, you had drug problems and alcohol problems. Did you see that in retrospect as connecting to manic depression?
Well,
do you think you were trying to self-medicate?
Well, they say that. You know what? I think I would have had probably drug problems anyway because it's in my family. But they always say 60% of all manic depressives are drug addicts or alcoholics, and I always wanted to meet the other 40% because I'm wondering what the hell they were doing, just like grooving on the moods. They're tough moods, you know? Well, I met the other 40% in the mental hospital, and they are grooving on the moods. I mean, they're just really talk about every inch and nook and cranny of the mood, and here's how I feel, and here's the medication I want and must have, and I think I'd rather be the 60%. But I don't, you know, I think that you would still be a drug addict. It's not a get-out-of-jail-free card to be a manic depressive, and so I self-medicate, and that's why I'm a drug addict. I think they probably exist together and, you know, and separately too. Yes, I self-medicate. And I think I would, given my family history and, I don't know, my predisposition, I'd probably have taken the drugs too.
So what do you do now?
Just I do radio shows. I snort radio shows. You mean, what do I do now? In what way?
Are you fun? No, for medication.
I take a lot of this dreck they give me for being a manic depressive. It's a horror. I take the little round watchful pills they give me to keep my moods under control. And that's it. I'm consigned to this sort of this way. I have to be under control. I do this. I have an 11-year-old daughter. I am not going to put my daughter under any sort of stresses. I've read, actually, it was the daughter of the Queen of Sheba. It was a book that a woman, I think, worked at NPR, right?
That's correct.
That book really disturbed me. It was very upsetting for me because it was written from the daughter of a manic depressive's point of view. And I just would never want to make my daughter's life like that.
Right.
And I don't think my daughter has seen me, certainly, manic. And, you know, she'd call my daughter called the moods the fast and slow. But I don't want to do that to my daughter. So even if I would be tempted to want to be manic again, which is amazing considering my age, me sort of running around Tijuana at 47.
In writing this novel, The Best Awful, about a woman who, like you, has bipolar disorder, did you have to stand back and see what that looks like?
Definitely.
From the point of view of, like, your friends, your family, your ex-husband.
Yeah, I don't, and the awful thing is to put that look in people's eyes, at any age, but, you know, at middle age, it's really insane. Yes, I had to stand back and look at it, and it's inappropriate at any age, but and certainly, you know, you want people to have compassion, and then you just think, I'm really pushing this, you know. But I have to stand back and look at it like it's a character.
Mm-hmm. So is it helpful at all in getting control of it to have stood back and written about a character with bipolar disorder? Once you're in the grip of it, does it not really matter that you've been able to stand back?
But in the grip of it, I have this thing that is standing back and watching it.
Oh, yeah?
Which has probably saved my life half the time.
That's like the writerly part of you.
There's somebody watching.
Yeah.
The only reason I remember something in the 6 days that I stayed awake, which felt like I was going to die. I mean, that's how they torture people. You know, soldiers or whatever you... I don't know what they do to the soldiers for keeping them awake. What do they get out of them? But I know now how they feel really pretty awful. But there was something in me tethered that stood back and watched. And it's that thing that can write the books. And I guess it's that thing that it's not cathartic, but it's that thing that's sort of sensible in me that's, you know, that does make me write, that has always stayed there and watched. That's watched while I was, you know, children of celebrities, that's watched while I was married to a celebrity that was, while I was Princess Leia, that has just watched all this stuff that's crazy, that doesn't make any sense on a sensible person.
Now, you were hospitalized when you had your psychotic incident, and
yeah.
And part of the therapy, I think, was group therapy. Was,
oh,
you know,
my God,
right?
It was so awful. Yeah.
Well, but, you know, it strikes me you've been in 12-step
so
programs.
Forever. I've done everything now.
Yeah, so what are some of the differences between, like, a 12-step program and group therapy in, you know, in a mental institution?
Oh, wait,
you're dealing
now,
with other people who are psychotic.
I don't know the difference. I've never been in, like, standard group therapy outside of, like, where I'm in a place.
Mm-hmm.
So I've been in rehab group therapy, I guess. And it's so awful. Because in the mental institute group therapy, you just feel like you're imprisoned there. And there's no real goal, I don't think. But in the mental hospital for 6 months, we talked about, remember the 40% of the manic depressives
right.
that weren't? We talked to them. And I listened to those people who wanted to talk about every area of their mood that they felt yesterday and this morning and at noon. And everybody talked, and it was all very critical. And we were there for 6 hours without break, listening to everybody's everything and the boxes they moved. And their husband wouldn't help them move them and wouldn't talk to them that lunch. And it was unbelievable. And I'm sure, and I was boring too, and we all were trapped. And there wasn't really any goal. I mean, it wasn't like it was therapy. It was just talking. We were just there.
Carrie Fisher, her new novel is called The Best Awful. She'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by BarnesandNoble.com, offering more than 30 million used and out-of-print books at www.bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Delta Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of Cinema Therapy for the Soul, The Girl's Guide to Finding Inspiration One Movie at a Time, by Nancy Pesky and Beverly West. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Coming up, we continue our conversation with actress and writer Carrie Fisher. Also, Egyptian human rights activist and publisher Hisham Kassem tells us how he manages to publish Cairo Times, his weekly English-language news magazine, despite the fact that it's banned from being printed in Egypt. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with actress and writer Carrie Fisher. She's best known for playing Princess Leia in Star Wars and for writing the best-selling novel Postcards from the Edge, which was adapted into a film starring Meryl Streep. Fisher's new novel, The Best Awful, is a sequel to Postcards from the Edge. Both novels are autobiographical. In the novel, your character is kind of forced to come out publicly as having, you know, bipolar disorder. Why don't you explain why she's forced to do that?
Well, she's in the hospital, and they put it in the what are they called? The tabloids. As, you know, Suzanne Vail's tragic life, which did happen to me. But it was I did get to get out of the hospital then.
Because of the tabloid?
Yeah.
What was the connection?
Well, because someone had sold my story, basically said something that I had said in the hospital.
Oh, even someone on the staff reported it?
No, one of the patients, I guess, somebody.
Oh.
And so they'd broken my anonymity or whatever. And I got to leave early. So it was, you know, anyway, so then it was out that I was bipolar. Anyway, it was out. So then once it was out, I sort of felt, well, if it's out their way, I kind of would rather have it come out my way. So I wanted to organize myself around how it was going to be said that I was bipolar, how it was going to be said that I was in the crazy house.
Is that part of the reason why you wrote this novel?
Part of it, yeah.
And so
part of the reason why I write any of the things I write.
Right, right. But I'm sure you wanted to kind of have that explanation made public long before this novel was published, because the episode you're talking about was several years ago. So
6.
Okay, 6 years ago. So what did you do closer to that time?
Well, they came to me, you know, and would ask me to...
Who
you
reporters?
You know, you feel
or?
So dumb, yeah. No, I think I went on Diane Sawyer. And you do feel dumb with... You know, I don't want to, the last thing I want to do is go on a show and weep and confess to my newest thing of the horror that happened. But I did go on a show and tell a thing that happened and talk about that thing. And there's no way to do like a laughing version, I suppose. But I never felt that bad about this somehow, and I still don't. And maybe I don't feel like it's that so horribly stigmatized or awful. And maybe there's something additional wrong with me that I don't. But I don't.
Is the public knowledge that you had this, you know, that you have manic depression, that you had this break, is that affecting your ability to get work, either as an actress or as a screenwriter?
No, I've worked, I've played 2 nuns since then. What does that say? I don't think it, not that I know of, nor I'm not privy to what happens in rooms where they decide whether I should have gotten something that I didn't get, but no, I'm working pretty much. It probably my age works against me more than my manic depression. That's a bigger disease. Ageism. I think mental illness works for me and my age works against me. What about that?
Huh. Now, the character in your novel, like you, is the daughter of a celebrity mother who was a movie star and then sang in clubs. Your mother, of course, is Debbie Reynolds. What was the status of your mother's career when you were old enough to be conscious of that?
She was doing mostly clubs, I think. We were in Las Vegas a lot. And then I started doing nightclub work with her, like most teenagers. And then...
very funny.
And then I did... I was a chorus girl with her in New York, again, like most teenagers. But mostly, I think we were in Las Vegas.
So when you were a chorus girl in your mother's act, what exactly were you doing?
I was dancing and singing.
What kind of songs?
Oh, let me see. Oh, the play was Irene. So it was Irene, a little bit of salt and sweetness. It was all this sort of 20s stuff. I was 15. And
so you were in a musical. This wasn't a club act. This was a musical.
Oh, no. I was in a club act, though.
You were in a club
that
act,
was
too.
When I was 13. And uh-huh. I did sing one of Paul Simon's songs, Bridge Over Troubled Water, when I was 14.
Oh, foreshadowing what
yes.
was to happen
now,
in the future.
Yes, there's constant foreshadowing of weirdness. And so that's... See, if I didn't write about it, if it was just... Otherwise, it would just be true, you see? Well, it just is the weirdest life. So that's why I write it.
Now, what did being in Irene and being in your mother's club act look like to you as a young teenager? And this would have been in the late 60s, maybe?
No, let's see. I was born in 56. So when I was 15, what does that do for us? 71.
Okay. So, you know, this is a period when there's a lot of, like, radical politics and, you know, the kind of tail end of the hippie era. And I don't know what you were aspiring to, but there you were in Vegas. did it feel like where you wanted to be?
15, I was in New York.
Oh, okay.
And before that, I was on the road doing her act, yeah. At 15, I was in New York, and we lived next to a funeral parlor. My mother was having her nervous breakdown. I was a chorus girl. I was in love with all the chorus boys. How about that for foreshadowing? Oh, just a huge amount of foreshadowing. And I think I got my first kiss from a gay guy. Oh, but that was on the road with the nightclub act. A guy named Lynn. He was Rip Taylor's boyfriend. That was great. And then I was in the chorus, and my mother was not in great shape. And I was a teenager, so I was living upstairs. She was downstairs. And then I went away to school in England, to drama college. My mother and I feuded a lot then.
And was it good to get away?
It was fantastic. By then, I didn't want to go to school in England, but it was good to get away when I finally did. She made me go, because I was going to bring respectability to the family.
In your novel, The Best Awful, your main character, who is the daughter of a celebrity, says that she thought a law ought to be passed forbidding two celebrities from actually breeding. It led to alcohol addiction and self-obsession without actually having a real sense of self. From your point of view, what are some of the problems of being the child of celebrities?
Well, celebrities are very busy. It's a narcissistic, unless you really concentrate, it can be a very, you know, self-centered, self-oriented profession. That your product is yourself. So, you know, when you have a child, the child has to be the focus, right? Children are normally, you have a child and then the child's the focus. But celebrities, their whole instrument is their self. And so the focus is off. Unless you have a very enlightened celebrity who's not going to do that. And it is, I think it's getting better now. And I was being glib when I wrote that. But the first crop of celebrities that had children, Tracy Ullman gave me a book that, horrifying titled books of like, you know, suicide in show business. And it does suicide. It's not just like celebrities, and it's just everybody of like, you know, gaffers and cameramen. Uh-huh. And but it's
excuse
just
me for a, laughing. Yeah,
there's a huge rash of, you know, second generation
yeah.
kids.
Yeah,
that just did not, you know, and it's alarming. And I don't know what caused that, but it's frightening.
One more question: do you ever go to the Star Wars conventions?
Not, I don't know. I think I have. I think I've been to, yeah.
I assume there are Star Wars conventions.
I've been to an autograph thing of theirs.
Uh-huh.
And it was beyond belief. I wanted to make a documentary of the people that get in the outfits. One woman cried and said that I had inspired her. I said, to what end? What are you? She said, a lawyer. And I didn't know how Princess Leia had inspired her to be a lawyer. But, you know, I talk to a man who made cardboard.
I meet all, it was very interesting.
What's your favorite line or the line you think of as being most ridiculous from the original Star Wars film that you had to say?
I have placed information vital to the survival of the rebellion in this R2 unit. There's a couple of those like that. I know them still because I had to memorize them. Let's see. I have placed information vital to the survival of the rebellion. It's the whole speech of the, I still know it. That's what's so tragic. What if I get senile and that is all the stuff that I say while drooling? Years ago, you served my father in the Clone Wars. I'm some old, damaged, and they just are making fun of me and what the people do to me at night and just have me say Star Wars dialogue, and they bring in their friends, you know, the orderlies in the old folks home that I'm in.
Oh, it sounds like an episode of The Twilight Zone.
That'll be my next book. Me as an old woman, having them dress me as Princess Leia in the old folks home.
Well, Carrie Fisher, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Carrie Fisher's new novel is called The Best Awful. Coming up, publishing an Egyptian news magazine, even though it's banned from being published in Egypt. This is Fresh Air. My guest, Hisham Kasum, has figured out how to do things that he's not allowed to do in Egypt. He publishes Cairo Times, Egypt's only independent English-language news magazine, and he manages to get it out each week, even though it's banned from being published in Egypt. Since September of 2000, Kasum has headed the Egyptian Organization for Human Rights, a group that's only been legal in Egypt since last June. He's now visiting Washington, D.C., where he's on a panel of judges deciding on this year's recipient of the Roger Baldwin Human Rights Award given by the group Human Rights First. I asked Kasum to describe his news magazine, Cairo Times.
Cairo Times is an independent weekly news magazine. I started in 1997 with a focus on informing readers, i.e. it's not something that's catering to a political party or the government. I try and run it as independently as possible. Been in trouble with the government once in a while.
What kind of trouble have you gotten into?
Censorship or being banned from printing in Egypt. And to this day, I'm still registered abroad. I can't get a registration in Egypt, so I had to register it abroad, first in Cyprus. And then when things got tight, because there were roughly 300 publications coming out of Egyptian publications registered in Cyprus. So the Egyptian, the Cypriot government put their foot down and made it very difficult to continue operating this way. I eventually moved my registration to Delaware.
Delaware in the United States?
The United States.
That's really funny.
Yeah, well, it was the easiest place for
me
to register.
Yeah. Why is it easier to register in Delaware of all places?
There are 52 places worldwide where you can register offshore companies. The easiest place was Delaware. But as far as I was concerned, it could have been the British Virgin Islands, the Cayman Islands, Hong Kong, uh-huh, Liechtenstein, you know, anywhere where you can register a company and operate abroad.
Since you're registered in Delaware, does that mean that you're not subjected to any press restrictions that are on the Egyptian press?
No. It's quite the contrary, because I'm considered a foreign publication. Now, well, that was the idea of making licensing difficult in Egypt. You're considered a foreign publication, so the government uses the pretext that you can be a threat to national security or to the morals of the nation, so they you have to go through censorship. So each week, the magazine has to be cleared by a censor before it hits the market. I've been censored for all sorts of things, tackling corruption, criticism of the regime. Yani, tolerance on the whole is quite low.
What is the worst punishment that has been inflicted by the government, either on the magazine and its ability to publish, or on you or your writers, you or your reporters?
probably the worst thing that they ever did against me was they banned me from printing in Egypt. So I'd basically prepare the magazine, take the films with me necessary for printing, fly to Cyprus, print in Cyprus, and bring in the copies with me as cargo on the plane, where they'd be seized in the airport. I can go on with stories forever. Again, the idea that I remain registered abroad as opposed to Egypt is sometimes a very painful one.
Well, now that you're licensed in Delaware, you don't have to fly to Delaware to to publish, do you?
No, you can fly almost anywhere in the world, anywhere there aren't such restrictions on printing. If you go to Cyprus, they don't ask you where your license is. They say, show us your money.
Right.
We'll print for you.
Were you brought up with the knowledge that if you remained an independent thinker, that you would face a lot of struggles?
I guess my father was quite an influence on me in that sense, and I remember when I first started getting in trouble and being summoned by state security, my father warned me that very soon they'd try and get me to work for the regime and, turn me into a snitch, basically, and said that if I did not have the caliber or the stamina to stand up for what I believe in, then he advised me to step out rather than do something as shameful as, working for security apparatuses or for government.
Did his prophecy come true? Were you approached by the government and asked to be a snitch?
Loads of times.
How do they do it?
They sit, they tell you, you're a smart guy, there's a lot of potential for you, etc., and try and tempt you. But I guess by now they've given up.
So you know people who are snitches, who said yes?
Oh, yeah. Loads.
And do they know you know?
Yeah. It's sometimes even embarrassing sitting with them. But I try not to get personal.
How effective are the snitches if you, and I imagine other people too, know who they are?
Well, a few years ago, this respectable editor who complained to the prime minister, I think, saying that, your snitches are the worst caliber journalists and humanly as well. And the prime minister's reply was, do you think anybody who's respectable or of any caliber would agree to be a snitch? So I guess, that answers.
How many years has Egypt been under martial law?
Well, throughout the Mubarak regime, it's been under martial law. But it was only freed
from
it for about
22 years,
since 1981. But it had only been freed from it for about 5 or 6 months and then reimposed again. So that gap aside, I think it's closer to 40 years now, or maybe more.
So what does that mean in terms of daily life? What are some of the things that you cannot do because of martial law?
Well, it seriously curbs any potential for political activism. Like any meeting where there are more than 5 people, you come under the brunt of martial law. You could be arrested for that. 6 people debating on politics could be considered a violation. And in many ways, martial law is becoming a law of its own, or a parallel law, or a legal reality.
My guest is Hisham Kasem. He's president of the Egyptian Organization for Human Rights and publishes the independent English-language news magazine, Cairo Times. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
My guest is Hisham Kasem. He's president of the Egyptian Organization for Human Rights and publishes the independent English-language news magazine, Cairo Times. Before the war in Iraq, you were a supporter of the war and thought that it might help push democracy not only in Iraq but in other countries in the Arab world. Do you still feel that way? Do you still feel confident that there will be an emerging democracy in Iraq and in other Arab countries as well?
Yes, certainly. I mean, I saw the military intervention in Iraq as a correction of American foreign policy. For years, whether the United States or Europe had supported what they call the stable regimes, which were basically our plight or the dictatorships that vary from psychopathic, like in Iraq, or authoritarian, like in Egypt. It certainly had the impact on the region. We're beginning to see regimes opening up. They all realize that there is no future for authoritarian regimes. I saw the intervention as a way to evade a much wider intervention, because the Arab region was headed to a situation where you'd probably have three or four failed states. The demographics show that 60% of the population are under 25, and no job creation because of the lack of development. And this is because of the lack of accountability and democracy. I saw the intervention as a lesser evil, and the effect is beginning to clearly be seen there.
What effect are you seeing?
All across the region, you're seeing regimes that are becoming tolerant of dissent, like suddenly a place like Saudi Arabia is allowing a human rights organization to be set up, a human rights conference to be held there. They're talking about elections. There's a wave of elections taking place across the region. Most of this is cosmetic. I don't see any of the regimes truly have a commitment for reform, but it's the realization that either they move in that direction or they risk the downfall of their own regime. We've seen something like the Colonel Gaddafi in Libya backtracking on his futile or silly program of weapons of mass destruction and beginning to realize that the money should be used in the development of the country rather than on ridiculous projects like that. I mean, I could go on forever about the changes happening now.
What was your reaction to the report by the former U.S. weapons inspector, David Kaye, that it looks like Iraq didn't have weapons of mass destruction any longer, that they haven't had weapons like that since, I think, 98 was the year that he gave?
Well, I mean, to me, the issue of weapons of mass destruction was something I never really bought or went along with. I didn't think Saddam had weapons of mass destruction or delivery systems. But to begin with, if that was the threat to American national security, and I'm talking from your perspective now, there is a much bigger threat to American national security, and that was to have three or four failed states, three or four Afghanistans by the oil depots of the world. And even with the correction in American foreign policy that will allow the chance for development to start taking place, I think there still will be failed states. So I guess it's an issue of that this was the pretext that the government went to war over. But in my case, my support was not over WMD. It was liberate the people of Iraq. A military intervention is something that is easy to make a decision about. Is the cost of the intervention in human life less than the regime staying? I think it is. And upon this, my support was for the intervention.
Now, you are an intellectual and a human rights activist and a publisher. I have read that there are places throughout the Middle East, and I've read specifically that this has been true in Cairo, where a lot of people believe that there was a Jewish conspiracy behind September 11th, that all the Jews who worked in the World Trade Center were told not to show up on September 11th, because the whole thing was part of this Jewish conspiracy. I'm wondering if you come across a lot of that thinking, and as an educated person, as an intellectual, what you make of it.
No, sadly, of course, that conspiracy theory did rotate around for a while, and several other conspiracy theories just as ridiculous. This is probably the result of the total meltdown of information systems in the region, and not leaving scope for decent media to exist. It's, to me, something that could be a cause of a lifetime to help get out of this situation.
Have there been a lot of publications that have printed conspiracy theories like that, that help generate theories like that?
Yes, under authoritarian regimes, the best and brightest journalists either leave the country, and people begin to realize that to make it up in the media, you basically need to be a government sycophant. Yeah, and it reflects on the quality and the professionalism of the whole industry. And eventually you get theories like that filling the pages.
In Egypt, there were a lot of anti-war protests before the war in Iraq. Did the war activate radical sentiments or anti-American sentiments in Egypt?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, anti-Americanism is at its highest. I've never seen anything like this, because prior to that there was also the issue of the Intifada and the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. However, it's not accumulative. It's not something that's building into institutions and collective bargaining over the matter. Now, if the United States can stabilize Iraq and succeed in the roadmap, which I'm optimistic about both, it will have to follow with something like a Marshall Plan for development, because the GDP of the region, there is no chance that we conduct the development on our own. And right now, I don't think Europe is going to be the necessary partner in this development, nor will Japan. And so that leaves the United States. If a Marshall Plan is introduced and it helps revitalize the economy and brings about jobs, most of the sentiment will be gone.
Well, I want to thank you very much, and I wish you a good stay in the United States.
Thank you.
Hisham Kassem is president of the Egyptian Organization for Human Rights, and he publishes the English-language news magazine Cairo Times. He spoke to us from Washington, D.C., where he's on a panel of judges deciding this year's recipient of the Roger Baldwin Human Rights Award, which is given by the group Human Rights First. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Ian Chillog, and Jessica Chu. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, how Vermont became the first legislature in the U.S. to legalize civil unions for gay and lesbian couples. We talk with David Motes about his new book, Civil Wars. He's the editorial page editor for the Rutland Herald in Vermont and won a Pulitzer Prize for his editorials supporting legalizing civil unions. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.